The English New Testament and the Court of Rome. Chapter 8. The Papacy Intercepts the Gospel. The Son of the Word of God, which daily grew brighter in the sky of the 16th century, was sufficient to scatter all the darkness in England. But popery, like an immense wall, intercepted its rays. Britain had hardly received the scriptures in Greek and Latin, and then in English, before the priests began to make war upon them with indefatigable zeal. It was necessary that the wall should be thrown down in order that the sun might penetrate freely among the Anglo-Saxon people. And now events were ripening in England, destined to make a great breach in popery. The negotiations of Henry VIII with Clement VII play an important part in the Reformation. By showing up the court of Rome, they destroyed the respect which the people felt for it. They took away that power and strength, as Scripture says, which the monarchy had given it, and the throne of the Pope once fallen in England, Jesus Christ uplifted and strengthened his own. Henry, ardently desiring an heir, and thinking that he had found the woman that would ensure his own and England's happiness, conceived the design of severing the ties that united him to the Queen, and with this view he consulted his most favorite counselors about the divorce. There was one in particular whose approval he coveted. This was Sir Thomas More. One day, as Erasmus's friend was walking with his master in the beautiful gallery at Hampton Court, giving him an account of a mission he had just executed on the continent, the king suddenly interrupted him. "My marriage with the queen," he said, "is contrary to the laws of God, of the church, and of nature." He then took up the Bible and pointed out the passages in his favor. "I am not a theologian," said More, somewhat embarrassed. "Your majesty should consult a council of doctors." Accordingly, by Henry's order, Warham assembled the most learned canonists at Hampton Court, but weeks passed away before they could agree. Most of them quoted in the king's favor those passages which forbid a man to take his brother's wife. But Fisher, Bishop of Rochester, and the other opponents of the divorce, replied that, when a woman is left a widow without children, her brother-in-law ought to take her to wife, to perpetuate his brother's name in Israel. "This law concerned the Jews only," replied the partisans of the divorce. They added that its object was to maintain the inheritances distinct and the genealogies intact until the coming of Christ. The Judaical dispensation has passed away, but the law of Leviticus, which is a moral law, is binding upon all men in all ages. To free themselves from their embarrassment, the bishops demanded that the most eminent universities should be consulted, and commissioners were forthwith dispatched to Oxford, Cambridge, Paris, Orleans, Toulouse, Louvain, Padua, and Bologna, furnished with money to reward the foreign doctors for the time and trouble this question would cost them. This caused some little delay, and every means was now to be tried to divert the king from his purpose. Wolsey, who was the first to suggest the idea of a divorce, was now thoroughly alarmed. It appeared to him that a nod from the daughter of the Boleyns would hurl him from the post he had so laboriously won, and this made him vent his ill humor on all about him, at one time threatening Warham, and at another persecuting Pace. But fearing to oppose Henry openly, he summoned from Paris Clark, Bishop of Bath and Wells, at that time ambassador to the French court. The latter entered into his views, and after cautiously preparing the way, he ventured to say to the king, "The progress of the inquiry will be so slow, Your Majesty, that it will take more than 7 years to bring it to an end." "Since my patience has already held out for 18 years, the king replied coldly, "I am willing to wait 4 or 5 more." As the political party had failed, the clerical party set in motion a scheme of another kind. A young woman, Elizabeth Barton, known as the Holy Maid of Kent, had been subject from childhood to epileptic fits. The priest of her parish, named Masters, had persuaded her that she was inspired of God, and confederating with one Bocking, a monk of Canterbury, he turned the weakness of the prophetess to account. Elizabeth wandered over the country, passing from house to house, and from convent to convent. On a sudden her limbs would become rigid, her features distorted. Violent convulsions shook her body, and strange unintelligible sounds fell from her lips, which the amazed bystanders received as revelations from the Virgin and the saints. Fisher, Bishop of Rochester, Abel, the Queen's ecclesiastical agent, and even Sir Thomas More, were among the number of Elizabeth's partisans. Rumors of the divorce having reached the saint's ears, an angel commanded her to appear before the cardinal. As soon as she stood in his presence, the color fled from her cheeks, her limbs trembled, and falling into an ecstasy, she exclaimed, "Cardinal of York, God has placed three swords in your hand, the spiritual sword to range the church under the authority of the Pope, the civil sword to govern the realm, and the sword of justice to prevent the divorce of the king. If you do not wield these three swords faithfully, God will lay its sword to your charge." After these words the prophetess withdrew. But other influences were then dividing Wolsey's breast: hatred, which induced him to oppose the divorce, and ambition, which foreboded his ruin in this opposition. At last ambition prevailed, and he resolved to make his objections forgotten by the energy of his zeal. Henry hastened to profit by this change. "Declare the divorce yourself," said he to Wolsey. "Has not the Pope named you his vicar general?" The cardinal was not anxious to raise himself so high. "If I were to decide the affair," said he, "the queen would appeal to the Pope. We must therefore either apply to the Holy Father for special powers, or persuade the queen to retire to a nunnery. And if we fail in either of these expedients, we will obey the voice of conscience, even in despite of the Pope." It was arranged to begin with the more regular attempt, and Gregory de Casale, Secretary Knight, and the protonotary Gambara were appointed to an extraordinary mission at the pontifical court. Casale was Wolsey's man, and Knight was Henry's. Wolsey told the envoys, "You will demand of the Pope, 1 SDLY, a commission authorizing me to inquire into this matter, 2 NDLY, his promise to pronounce the nullity of Catherine's marriage with Henry, if we should find that her marriage with Arthur was consummated, and 3 RDLY, a dispensation permitting the king to marry again." In this manner Wolsey hoped to make sure of the divorce without damaging the papal authority. It was insinuated that false representations, with regard to the consummation of the first marriage, had been sent from England to Julius II, which had induced the pontiff to permit the second. The Pope being deceived as to the fact, his infallibility was untouched. Wolsey desired something more. Knowing that no confidence could be put in the good faith of the pontiff, he demanded a fourth instrument, by which the Pope should bind himself never to recall the other three. He only forgot to take precautions in case Clement should withdraw the fourth. "With these four snares skillfully combined," said the cardinal, "I shall catch the hare. If he escapes from one, he will fall into the other." The courtiers anticipated a speedy termination of the affair. Was not the emperor the declared enemy of the pontiff? Had not Henry, on the contrary, made himself protector of the Clementine League? Could Clement hesitate, when called upon, to choose between his jailer and his benefactor? Indeed, Charles V, at this moment, was in a very embarrassing position. It is true, his guards were posted at the gates of the castle of St. Angelo, where Clement was a prisoner, and people in Rome said to one another with a smile, "Now indeed it is true, Papa non potest errare." But it was not possible to keep the Pope a prisoner in Rome, and then what was to be done with him? The Viceroy of Naples proposed to Alarcon, the governor of St. Angelo, to remove Clement to Gaeta, but the affrighted colonel exclaimed, "Heaven forbid that I should drag after me the very body of God." Charles thought one time of transporting the pontiff to Spain, but might not an enemy's fleet carry him off on the road? The Pope in prison was far more embarrassing to Charles than the Pope at liberty. It was at this critical time that Francis Philip, Queen Catherine's servant, having escaped the snares laid by Henry VIII and Wolsey, arrived at Madrid, where he passed the whole day in conference with Charles V. This prince was at first astonished, shocked even, by the designs of the King of England. The curse of God seemed to hang over his house. His mother was a lunatic, his sister of Denmark expelled from her dominions, his sister of Hungary made a widow by the Battle of Mohacs. The Turks were encroaching upon his territories. Lautrec was victorious in Italy, and the Catholics, irritated by the Pope's captivity, detested his ambition. This was not enough. Henry VIII was striving to divorce his aunt, and the Pope would naturally give his aid to this criminal design. Charles must choose between the pontiff and the king. The friendship of the King of England might aid him in breaking the league formed to expel him from Italy, and by sacrificing Catherine he would be sure to obtain his support. But placed between reasons of state and his aunt's honor, the emperor did not hesitate. He even renounced certain projects of reform that he had at heart. He suddenly decided for the Pope, and from that very hour followed a new course. Charles, who possessed great discernment, had understood his age. He had seen that concessions were called for by the movement of the human mind, and would have desired to carry out the change from the Middle Ages to modern times by a carefully managed transition. He had consequently demanded a council to reform the church and weaken the Romish dominion in Europe. But very different was the result. If Charles turned away from Henry, he was obliged to turn towards Clement, and after having compelled the head of the church to enter a prison, it was necessary to place him once more upon the throne. Charles V sacrificed the interests of Christian society to the interests of his own family. This divorce, which in England has been looked upon as the ruin of the popedom, was what saved it in continental Europe. But how could the emperor win the heart of the pontiff, filled as it was with bitterness and anger? He selected for this difficult mission a friar of great ability, D'Angelis, general of the Spanish observance, and ordered him to proceed to the castle of St. Angelo under the pretext of negotiating the liberation of the Holy Father. The courtier was conducted to the strongest part of the fortress, called the Rock, where Clement was lodged, and the two priests brought all their craft to bear on each other. The monk, assisted by the artful Moncade, adroitly mingled together the Pope's deliverance and Catherine's marriage. He affirmed that the emperor wished to open the gates of the pontiff's prison, and had already given the order. And then he added immediately, "The emperor is determined to maintain the rights of his aunt, and will never consent to the divorce." "If you are a good shepherd to me," wrote Charles to the Pope with his own hand on the 22nd of November, "I will be a good sheep to you." Clement smiled as he read these words. He understood his position. The emperor had need of the priest. Charles was at his captive's feet. Clement was saved. The divorce was a rope fallen from the skies which could not fail to drag him out of the pit. He had only to cling to it quietly in order to reascend his throne. Accordingly, from that hour Clement appeared less eager to quit the castle than Charles to liberate him. "So long as the divorce is in suspense," thought the crafty de' Medici, "I have two great friends, but as soon as I declare for one, I shall have a mortal enemy in the other." He promised the monk to come to no decision in the matter without informing the emperor. Meantime night, the envoy of the impatient monarch, having heard, as he crossed the Alps, that the Pope was at liberty, hastened on to Parma, where he met Gambara. "He is not free yet," replied the protonotary, "but the general of the Franciscans hopes to terminate his captivity in a few days. Continue your journey," he added. Knight could not do so without great danger. He was told at Foligno, 60 miles from the metropolis, that if he had not a safe conduct he could not reach Rome without exposing his life. Knight halted. Just then a messenger from Henry brought him dispatches more pressing than ever. Knight started again with one servant and a guide. At Monte Rotondo he was nearly murdered by the inhabitants. But on the next day, November 25th, protected by a violent storm of wind and rain, Henry's envoy entered Rome at 10 o'clock without being observed, and kept himself concealed. It was impossible to speak with Clement, for the emperor's orders were positive. Knight, therefore, began to practice upon the cardinals. He gained over the cardinal of Pisa, by whose means his dispatches were laid before the pontiff. Clement, after reading them, laid them down with a smile of satisfaction. "Good," said he. "Here is the other coming to me now." But Knight had hardly closed in before the cardinal of Pisa's secretary hastened to Knight and told him, "Don Alarcon is informed of your arrival, and the Pope entreats you to depart immediately." This officer had scarcely left him when the protonotary Gambara arrived in great agitation. "His Holiness presses you to leave. As soon as he is at liberty, he will attend to your master's request." 2 hours after this, 200 Spanish soldiers arrived, surrounded the house in which Knight had concealed himself, and searched it from top to bottom, but to no purpose. The English agent had escaped. Knight's safety was not the true motive which induced Clement to urge his departure. The very day on which the Pope received the message from the King of England, he signed a treaty with Charles V, restoring him under certain conditions to both his powers. At the same time the pontiff, for greater security, pressed the French general Lautrec to hasten his march to Rome in order to save him from the hands of the emperor. Clement, a disciple of Machiavelli, thus gave the right hand to Charles and the left to Francis, and as he had not another for Henry, he made him the most positive promises. Each of the three princes could reckon on the Pope's friendship, and on the same grounds. The 10th of December, 1527, was the day on which Clement's imprisonment would terminate, but he preferred owing his freedom to intrigue rather than to the emperor's generosity. He therefore procured the dress of a tradesman, and on the evening before the day fixed for his deliverance, his ward being already much relaxed, he escaped from the castle, and accompanied only by Louis of Gonzago in his flight, he made his way to Orvieto. While Clement was experiencing all the joy of a man just escaped from prison, Henry was a prey to the most violent agitation. Having ceased to love Catherine, he persuaded himself that he was the victim of his father's ambition, a martyr to duty, and the champion of conjugal sanctity. His very gait betrayed his vexation, and even among the gay conversation of the court, deep sighs would escape from his bosom. He had frequent interviews with Wolsey. "I regard the safety of my soul above all things," he said, "but I am concerned also for the peace of my kingdom. For a long while an unceasing remorse has been gnawing at my conscience, and my thoughts dwell upon my marriage with unutterable sorrow. God, in his wrath, has taken away my sons, and if I persevere in this unlawful union, he will visit me with still more terrible chastisements. My only hope is in the Holy Father." Wolsey replied with a low bow, "Please your majesty, I am occupied with this business, as if it were my only means of winning heaven." And indeed he redoubled his exertions. He wrote to Sir Gregory de Casale on the 5th of December, 1527, "You will procure an audience of the Pope at any price. Disguise yourself, appear before him as the servant of some nobleman, or as a messenger from the Duke of Ferrara. Scatter money plentifully, sacrifice everything, provided you procure a secret interview with His Holiness. 10,000 ducats are at your disposal. You will explain to Clement the king's scruples, and the necessity of providing for the continuance of his house and the peace of his kingdom. You will tell him that in order to restore him to liberty, the king is ready to declare war against the emperor, and thus show himself to all the world to be a true son of the church." Wolsey saw clearly that it was essential to represent the divorce to Clement VII as a means likely to secure the safety of the popedom. The cardinal, therefore, wrote again to de Casale on the 6th of December. "Night and day, I revolve in my mind the actual condition of the church, and seek the means best calculated to extricate the Pope from the gulf into which he has fallen. While I was turning these thoughts over in my mind during a sleepless night, one way suddenly occurred to me. I said to myself, the king must be prevailed upon to undertake the defense of the Holy Father. This was no easy matter, for His Majesty is strongly attached to the Emperor. However, I set about my task. I told the king that His Holiness was ready to satisfy him. I staked my honor. I succeeded. To save the Pope, my master will sacrifice his treasures, subjects, kingdom, and even his life. I therefore conjure His Holiness to entertain our just demand." Never before had such pressing entreaties been made to a pope.